帽，衬托斜斜黑帽。
Hello and welcome to ArtsLink on CJSW 90.9 FM, broadcasting out of the University of Calgary campus and from Treaty 7 lands. My name is Nathan Taylor and our usual co-host Jenny is taking a break from the program but may be back in the fall. On today's show, I have an interview with Ben Rowe, programming coordinator for Calgary Cinematheque, but first we're going to talk performing arts on campus. So as part of the 2024 Alchemy Festival at the University of Calgary, running from now until April 7th, we have one of the directors of one of the play's final chorus joining us here today, Andy Roy. Thank you for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us about your play. This is a war-based play.
Yeah, so basically the whole narrative explores themes of camaraderie, humanity, and just the impact of war on individuals as a whole.
And the plot is there's some soldiers who are holed up in a dilapidated castle waiting for some sort of, you know, final event. Is that right?
Yeah. So we kind of had the idea of making it more fantasy in the hopes that people understand that the setting kind of gives us space to explore current themes of war slightly out of that contemporary context.
Oh, I see. Rather than making it directly something 20th century.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. And... Now, this play, how did you come up with it?
So, it's actually a fun idea. It's originally, we decided to go with something called devised theater, which essentially, in my case, or in our play, it's we had an outline of what we kind of wanted to talk about. And then we got all the actors, my stage manager, and we came up with the dialogue, the actual play itself. And we flushed it out that way through rehearsal. So it was almost like an improvised rehearsal.
And so you were mentioning before we started the microphones that you didn't have a whole lot of time to do this. What was the period of time that you had to come up with this?
So essentially we had to pitch the idea, and within a month we kind of had to throw it on its feet and showcase something to our supervisors. And so we had a month to come up with like a short 5-minute scene. And then after that month, we had about a month, maybe 2 months to kind of figure out how we're going to make this 15-minute play. And we, like I said, we devised it all during this time. So we didn't really have a script or anything. So we came up with that all kind of in 2 months.
Now, there was something that was alluded to in the advertisement for this play about a song being sung that you're inviting the audience to participate in if they know the words. Now, this sounds like one of those kind of fun little surprises that you came across while developing this in the devised mode. Can you mention a little bit about that and maybe some other surprises that you found along the way?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, we started with the idea of doing the play, like I said, in the 20th century, but we found that it didn't give us enough space to kind of explore these, like, humanistic or the humanity of people, and we didn't really want to talk about the war aspect of it. So a lot of the things that we came up with were kind of just reminiscing about the past, and then we were really wanting to dig into that music side of things, because anytime that there's heartache or hardship, I feel like music helps a lot. So we were like, okay, well, maybe we can get like a sing-along song, like we can all kind of sing along with like a famous song or something, and then in hopes that the audience will join in.
What a great idea.
Yeah.
Now, thinking about what you're meant to sort of advertise a play for this Alchemy Festival, I was intrigued when I saw it because there's not a whole lot of information to go along. There was, you know, the aspect of the short description, which is, you know, dilapidated castle, camaraderie, the humanity, how they deal with war. And I like the idea of soldiers trying to shift gears into something that is less in killing mode and more into the family, familiarity mode. And so it was neat to see the advertisement. Seeing was kind of almost like a David Bowie-like effect with these animals superimposed on the faces of the soldiers. And so I just wanted to ask, how did you come up with this advertisement and what is the meaning of these animals?
So thankfully we have like a great artist, Nikki, that just every time that they do the posters, they kill it. So thankfully we have that person in our corner. But so again, with the devised theater, we the how we came up with the idea of the animals on the faces and or just like the clan tags, we called them. With the devised piece, I really wanted to make sure that the actors felt like it wasn't just them acting. I wanted to have every part of the creation process come from a collaborative effort. So I got each soldier, knight, to come up with their own clan tag. And they didn't have to explain it to me, what it meant or anything. But I wanted it to kind of just mean something to them. And so then one of my actors actually is very talented in 3D printing. So he designed it on his machine and then 3D printed them all. So we each have our own little clan tag or clan logo. And so each of us have that on our uniforms.
It's also neat to hear in your answer that there is room for ambiguity even from a director and a creator's standpoint. You're letting your soldiers, your actors, have a own little personal world that you don't necessarily need a window into. That's very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I really wanted something like that because I felt like it was it helped with that ownership of the entire play itself and the entire creation process.
Now, is there anything you want to say about what you want to do in your own art? I'm always kind of curious about what people want to do once they get their degrees and you go out into the wide world.
Yeah, I mean, I hope eventually, we all hope that we can kind of get a job out of university in your craft. So, I mean, I hope I can keep acting and directing my own content. And I eventually would like to open a production house or my own theater, but who knows what the world holds for me.
I hope you do. Thanks for talking to us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
That was director of Final Chorus, Andy Roy. Both evenings of the performance, Wednesday and Thursday, March 27th and 28th, begin at 6:30 p.m. in the Reeve Theater on the U of C campus. Final Chorus is one of three performances that night, with it in the middle at 7 p.m. Visit the ArtsLink section of cgsw.com for links to the U of C's 2024 Alchemy Festival, where you can claim your seat. Next up on ArtsLink is Ben Rowe, programming coordinator for Calgary Cinematheque, to tell us about the final two films in their latest series, Nuclear Horror, America and Japan, with The Incredible Shrinking Man on March 29th and Akira Kurosawa's I Live in Fear on April 4th, both at the Globe Cinema. So the next film in your series, which people can catch, is on Thursday, March 28th at the Globe at 7 p.m., The Incredible Shrinking Man. I have not seen this film. What can you tell us about it, and especially about the logistics that Richard Matheson went through in adapting his own book for screen?
Yeah, absolutely. So The Incredible Shrinking Man is sort of part of the later Universal sci-fi horror films in the 1950s. And it was a big contrast from what they normally had been doing up to that point. Director Jack Arnold was best known for The Creature from the Black Lagoon movies, and Universal had always been very monster-focused. But Incredible Shrinking Man is a very sort of internally focused story, focusing on the title character, Scott Carey. And so the novel is very internalized about this man's, you know, reactions to the situation that's happening around him, which could make it difficult to adapt, except that the central premise of someone, you know, shrinking from the size of an average man to, you know, almost like what we would consider like an action figure sort of size is very visually dramatic. And so it does, you know, come to film quite easily for that reason.
Reading about this film, I understand that it takes its time in showing him getting to doll size.
Yes, absolutely. With the overall series, the Nuclear Horror series we're presenting, you know, we have four films here, and they are designed as two pairs that contrast an American and Japanese film. And in the case of The Incredible Shrinking Man, what we're looking at is kind of internalized anxieties about man's place in the world. And so what we see with Scott Carey is this gradual transformation where he slowly loses his sense of self. He slowly experiences kind of an emasculation as he gets smaller. And, you know, if you think of this in the context of 1950s American society, which was very strongly informed by values of, you know, father knows best and, you know, a man's the king of his castle. What we see is, you know, at first shrinking to almost the size of a child and this emasculation he feels at his wife having to take care of him, at the fact that he can't, be there for his wife as a man should be, to, you know, becoming doll-sized, to even worse than that, and this slow, gradual realization on his part that he's going to keep shrinking until he's infinitesimally small. And ultimately what we're left with is that feeling that a lot of people had in the late 1950s of feeling suddenly very, very small in a world that was globalizing very quickly.
Now, when you mention internalization of fears, we really got to talk about that next film that you have, I Live in Fear. But I do want to hit a couple of the what I understand are the outstanding aspects of The Incredible Shrinking Man's special effects. So I've read that Jack Arnold he used three techniques that are fairly heavily used in the film. And the reviewer that I was looking at, a guy that makes a website called 1000 Misspent Hours, mentions that the back projection, the matte shots, and the forced perspective are some of the best he's ever seen, and movies even 20 years later cannot compare to the effects in this film.
I think that with the effects, what you're looking at is the fact that they knew that this was going to be the big selling point. They knew that if they didn't get these right, the whole movie was going to fall apart. And it's that mix of elements that makes it work. And that's true for film even today. When you rely on one technique, you are hampering yourself, even if it's easier to do. If you have multiple techniques, you can kind of create more of that sense of magic. So with forced perspective, that's similar to what you have in the original Lord of the Rings movies, where, you know, you put something closer to the camera, you put something farther away, and because film is a 2D plane, you can fake kind of the appearance of one thing looking bigger than the other. And that's especially used when he's kind of child-sized, because there are scenes where he meets a woman with dwarfism, and they go out on a date, and he's, you know, about the same height as she is, but of course he's still being played by the regular-sized actor, and so they're at the same table, but we're using forced perspective to make them look like they're the same size. With, you know, the matte stuff is done really well, where we're kind of, you know, matting them into shots that have been taken of a regular-sized cat and making that cat look ginormous. But I think one of the most clever things that they do is the creation of oversized sets and oversized props that are identical to regular-sized objects that they're shooting, such that we can see, you know, someone drop a pencil and then he picks it up and it's a lance from his perspective, that kind of thing.
Man, and, bringing it back to the date that you mentioned, most of my research in looking up clips of the film includes mostly the action-type scenes. So it is interesting to see how much of a character piece this is. I got to bring it up again because it seems unusual for what my pop culture saturation of knowing about this film is.
Absolutely, and it is absolutely a character piece. It's really unique among American science fiction films of this time for being so character-focused, and for ultimately being much more nihilistic than a lot of American science fiction films from this period. But of course, just as today, when you're looking at the marketing, you're looking at what's going to sell the picture to a wide audience. And so it's the spectacle of the special effects. It's the action scenes of, you know, him fighting a spider in the basement, that kind of thing. But what the film is really about is how he feels about what's happening around him and the anxieties that it's creating within him, and how those anxieties sort of reflect upon the anxieties that people were feeling at the time. And ultimately, these themes of, you know, feeling emasculated, feeling like you aren't living up to your role as a man and a husband, this feeling that you were once kind of king of your castle and now you're so small in this large world that looks down upon you quite literally, are given a lot of extra poignancy because Grant Williams, who plays the lead character, was a closeted homosexual in Hollywood at a time when you had things like the Lavender Scare that was driving homosexuals out of their jobs. And so those themes of, you know, am I man enough and inadequacy get this kind of extra poignancy because of the pathos that Grant Williams is able to bring to the character and to the role that is a step above a lot of the acting that you see in a lot of American science fiction from this period.
Yeah, and I did not know that until I saw the description talking about the metatextual aspect of this film. I'm just kind of curious about when was it known that he was in the closet? I'm just kind of curious how recent this development is.
It was certainly something that was rumored in Hollywood at the time. One of those things where, you know, if you were in the know at the time, but if you were someone, you know, in the audience, if you were a standard mainstream, you know, viewer of the film, you wouldn't have known anything about it. There was a whole studio publicity machine that existed at the time to shield actors and their secrets from the public, invent different ones for the public to find, perhaps to throw people off the trail. And ultimately, a lot of this didn't really come out until after he had passed away.
Okay. Well, you mentioned something earlier about the way that this The Incredible Shrinking Man was meant to be seen by an audience, sort of invoking the studio system and what were the expectations were for this film. I'd like to switch now over to the Akira Kurosawa film from 1955, I Live in Fear. And if you could describe what the film is about, and then maybe if we could dovetail into how the studio system worked over there, because we certainly aren't expecting the same sort of bombasticness from a Japanese film of this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I Live in Fear is what's going to close out the series, and it's the Japanese film that we're contrasting with Incredible Shrinking Man. It's Akira Kurosawa, who is, generally speaking, a fairly well-known Japanese director here in the West. He's responsible for Rashomon and Ikiru and Seven Samurai and Yojimbo, lots of famous films. But I feel like I Live in Fear is probably one of his most lesser-known films in the West. It's the only film that he did that directly dealt with nuclear themes. And its release in 1955 means that it's one of the earliest Japanese films to do so in general. The film we showed just prior, Godzilla, is the first Japanese cultural product to deal with the atomic bomb, and that was 1954. So I Live in Fear, 1955, is the same studio, Toho, and Kurosawa is one of their top directors. He had just done Seven Samurai. And it's sort of unique among our four films in being a drama as opposed to a sci-fi picture, but it deals very much with the same themes. As to its lack of bombast, while, you know, Godzilla is a big action kind of spectacle, those people who came out to our show of it would know that the original Godzilla is quite a dour film. It doesn't have the same kind of, you know, you don't cheer when the buildings get destroyed in the same way that you do in an American monster movie. And the dourness makes sense. What we're really looking at here with this series is that contrast between the way that these fears about nuclear power were expressed by America, which was the country developing that power, versus Japan, which was the country that had suffered the most from it. And so what we see in I Live in Fear is a continuation of the themes from The Incredible Shrinking Man, but being seen from this different cultural perspective. So with I Live in Fear, what we're seeing is a film about the patriarch of a Japanese family, an older man, played by frequent Kurosawa collaborator Toshiro Mifune, and his fear about the potential for nuclear holocaust. He's kind of a 1950s doom scroller, really, in a way. And his fears and paranoias and anxieties are becoming so extreme that they bring him into conflict with his family. And his family has to kind of go against him and against his wishes in order to secure their own well-being, which in 1950s Japan, a very highly patriarchal culture, a culture very much based around respect of your elders and about that family relationship, that's a big deal for the family to have to do that and to, you know, go against their father and try to get control of the family away from him. And so we see those themes of emasculation. We see those themes of that feeling of losing control as a man of the things you feel like should be your right, your home and your family, being repeated from Incredible Shrinking Man, but instead of being expressed in kind of this action-adventure story that turns into a kind of nihilistic tragedy. We see a film that dives into that tragedy aspect much earlier on and with much more direct sincerity.
Yeah, it sounds to me as though the difference in the focus on the logistics of the thing switches from, you know, the incredible shrinking man, you know, having to make his own clothing and shoes when he's finally that small, to, you know, someone who is trying to figure out how to protect his workers from the factory that he owns. And even small bits that when I rented this at Casablanca Video back in the day, as I guess you'd say, an introductory scene where Toshiro is frightened by a jet passing over head. Was very, very, it really cut to the bone. It was a very powerful moment. And don't want to spoil the ending to this film, but an amazing psycho ending to this film.
Absolutely. And what we kind of see is that difference in the way that these cultures will allow their protagonists to express their anxieties. You know, in the American film, Scott Carey becomes very aggravated and frustrated by his situation, and his anxieties come out in an aggressive fashion, kind of, you know, his defiance against what's happening around him, whereas the fears that Mifune's character have are coming out almost in irrationality, in kind of a, you know, flight response rather than the fight response we see in Shrinking Man.
How do these screenings in these series come about?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have our membership, and all it's required to become a member of the Calgary Cinematheque is to sign up for our newsletter, for our subscription on our website, calgarycinema.org. At that point, you're not paying anything, but you're a member and you get our communications, and we will put out a call for new members for our programming committee, which we actually just did. We actually just brought on some new programming committee members. Once you're on the programming committee, that committee meets irregularly to talk about, discuss what kind of films we want to program, what our programming season should look like. And we encourage our programmers to come up with series like this, to come up with ideas for themed series that can, you know, show 3 to 4 films that are connected in some way. And we encourage our programmers to think of more conceptual ideas than just 4 films directed by Woody Allen or, 3 films from 1930s Taiwan, right? To think of something a little more conceptual like this film series here, which has, 2 Japanese films, 2 American films kind of on this nuclear horror theme. And then if everyone likes kind of those series, it becomes the role of the programming chair, who is currently our board president, Scott Lang, to approve those series. And then I, as programming coordinator, have to go and get the rights for those movies and figure out what's available and potentially have to say, no, we can't show that movie because it's unavailable. We got to swap it with something else and work these things out until we have a curated season throughout the year that we feel flows well throughout the year so that we're not putting too many, say, dour series next to each other or, you know, and have kind of a nice, you know, okay, in summer, let's do something more fun or, you know, what have you. And then generally we encourage our programmers, whoever came up with the idea for the series to begin with, to help write copy for, you know, the series on our website describing what it's all about and to present the films in that series, say something before each film that contextualizes the film for the audience, especially within the concept of the series that's being presented, so that central sort of idea behind what we're programming and why is clear to the people who come out and see it. And they understand, you know, what the value of what they're seeing is in that context.
Calgary Cinematheque has always had interesting curated intros to the films, and my probably favorite movie-going experience was taking my mother to go see Once Upon a Time in the West, and a gentleman spoke about Ennio Morricone's music and the themes within. And I just got to say, that was one of the best times at the theater ever.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's important to contextualize some of these films, especially when they're from a different culture like Japan or from a different time even, like the 1950s, so that audiences can come at the films on the level that they were intended for and sort of meet these films on their own terms. It's very easy when you don't know a lot about what you're about to see to kind of approach older cinema from a position of detachment, from kind of an arm's length kind of view at things. And, you know, especially older science fiction, to think, oh, these, you know, special effects are hokey, so, you know, that's going to put me at a distance from the film. And, you know, ultimately for the film to have its proper power, you want to be kind of put in the shoes of people who saw it at the time and understand what was significant about it to them at the time. You know, with Godzilla that we just showed, you know, understanding the power that that would have for a Japanese audience, being much different than how, you know, we might take it today, so far removed from the, you know, atomic bombings and the culture that created it.
Well, Ben, this has been great talking to you about Calgary Cinematheque. Can you tell us what is on the horizon for you?
Absolutely. We have a lot of really exciting stuff coming up for the rest of the year. Probably the biggest thing that I'm excited about is May 30th. We're going to be doing a very special show, very different from what we normally do. We're showing the 1928 silent film, The Passion of Joan of Arc, from director Carl Dreyer. And we are going to be showing that silent film with live musical accompaniment. A composer named George Serra is coming in and going to have a string quartet and a choir and be giving live music to that silent film. And in order to present that in kind of a special venue that sort of gets across the power of the film but also helps support that musical experience, we're going to be showing it at Knox United Church. So it's going to be a really unique venue. We're going to be selling posters. We're going to be having, you know, a bit of a premium kind of experience when we're presenting that film. And May 30th is going to be the anniversary of when Joan of Arc was executed. So it's all, I'm very excited to be presenting this special show at the end of the month there.
Wow, yeah, that's really neat. The last one I can think of was Philip Glass doing Dracula. It's going to be really cool to see some live music in front of going during a film. That's very ambitious.
Absolutely, and it's, you know, it's something that this gentleman has composed specifically for Passion of Joan of Arc. It's been shown with this music in other cities in the past, and it's the first time it's coming to Calgary.
Well, I can't wait for that. Well, look, it's been great talking to you. We were talking, you know, maybe, you know, we'll do between five and 10 minutes. But Ben, it's been great listening to what you have to say about film. I found it very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for talking to me. And, you know, if anyone wants to learn more about what we're doing, calgarycinema.org is going to have all that information.
Well, that's all the time we have for ArtsLink this month. Join us next month on April 22nd. The fourth Monday of every month is when you'll find ArtsLink on CJSW 90.9 FM.